Hey guys, how's it going? See, why is it so peaceful in here? It's because I forgot to turn on Fox News in the background, man. For the corner of my eye. You know, to keep me fearful. All right, I'm just kidding. I'm Scott Horton. Today on the show, Mark Thornton and Reza Marashi. But first, Mark Thornton. Hey Mark, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing great. It's great to be shaking things up a little bit here today.
Yeah. Happy to start the show with a Mark Thornton interview for a change. Everybody, you know Mark. He is senior fellow at the Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. And he calls the bubbles before everybody else. That's basically his shtick. And so you've written this very interesting article, Gold and Economic Inequality. And I think I want to start with this. And then we got some other things to talk about, too. But it's all kind of the same thing. Gold and economic inequality. Now, I know you're a libertarian, which is not necessarily the same thing as being an Austrian school economist. And so I know that you don't favor egalitarian policies for their own sake or, you know, attempted ones. But you're arguing here that the less control the government has over the economy, the less inequality there will be between those who own the capital and those who work for them, broadly defined. But that's not what I learned in government school, which is that capitalism tends towards monopoly and richer people getting richer and richer and taking more and more of the pie at the expense of everybody else. And so government has to come and intervene with progressive taxation and take some of that extra money and give it to the poor people and all this kind of thing in order to balance this stuff out. So who's wrong? You or them?
Well, you put it very well, Scott. The traditional propaganda is that we need the state in order to suppress monopolies, in order to redistribute money and resources to poor people. But the reality is that capitalism on its own produces a very fair distribution of income with a small lower income class, a very large middle income class, and what I call revolving upper income class. The market economy doesn't provide people with monopolies. It doesn't provide them with privileges. It doesn't take away money in the form of taxes. And so it gives everybody the opportunity to work and to save and to invest and to be entrepreneurial and to move up the economic ladder, so to speak. So there's no need for welfare. There's no need to tax. There's no need to provide monopolies for, you know, extremely wealthy people. I think in a real capitalist system, a real free market, you wouldn't see these tremendous, outrageous, you know, like billion-dollar a year income situations for a small number of people while millions of people don't have access to jobs, have no incentive whatsoever to invest, and who face heavy taxes on the income that they do earn. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, okay, I got to admit that we do have the biggest government in the history of all of mankind, and this economic inequality that we're talking about exists contemporary, you know what I mean, contemporary, I can't say the damn word. I know it in my brain, but I can't make my tongue do it at the same damn time. And so, okay, you got me there. But on the other hand, a Republican or a Democrat listening is saying, come on, Mark Thornton, you're being utopian. Like every poor person is going to become a businessman as soon as you deregulate the rich people. Come on.
Well, Scott, I mean, that's what happens in the real world. When there's no blockages and there's opportunities, people take advantage of them. So, I mean, in the absence of government intervention and taxes and regulations and minimum wage laws and licensing requirements and all that, people would have easy access to jobs. There wouldn't be any real unemployment problem. And then there would be open opportunities to become entrepreneurs, usually small business people who employ other people. Right now we have a situation where if you want to go into business, you're usually going to have to get a license. You're going to have to meet all sorts of government regulations, red tape, paperwork. In the American economy, other countries, it's even worse. But it's very, very difficult to become your own entrepreneur today compared to 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago in this country. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk in these days about, you know, the minimum wage is too low, and Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, calling for wealth taxes. We've got a socialist in Bernie Sanders running for the U.S. president. Everybody's focused in on this economic inequality issue, and both the left and the right don't have the right solutions. You know, the left and the progressives, they want more welfare, they want better schools, they want free college, job training, on and on and on, whereas the conservative right wants welfare reform, charter schools, tax reform, and the negative income tax. And none of that stuff really gets to the heart of the issue. That's just taking wealth and resources from some and giving it to another, where the government takes a big cut in the process. Mm-hmm. And so neither side really understands it, and so neither side is really offering the real basic reform, which is less government regulations, less licensing requirements, and most importantly, what I point out in this article is that you need an honest monetary system. Gold is an honest monetary system, and it provides, you know, a much better system in which workers, savers, investors, entrepreneurs are grounded in the fact that money is a real tangible thing. And I know, Scott, in your heart, the gold standard also is a check against aggressive foreign policy and running up huge national debts, because under a gold standard, countries just can't borrow trillions of dollars to finance overseas empires. And so the gold standard is, you know, has always been a key issue with the Mises Institute and its members and its donors and its faculty, because it does provide this level playing field in which everybody benefits, and which also substantially constrains the ability of government to do the outrageous things that it does overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm sorry, you might have heard me laughing there. I was just thinking about my own stupidity earlier trying to talk. But, you know, I learned in junior college that, because inflation is good for the middle class, because they get to borrow in dollars and pay back in dimes. And that's why we have so many homeowners in America, such huge percentages of the population that own homes, is because they get to pay 30-year loans back in depreciating dollars. And thank goodness, otherwise they'd all just be living in boxes in apartments stacked on top of each other. So what about that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Home ownership is all fine and good, but in the modern economy, we don't need home ownership the way we did in previous decades. Now we have a more dynamic economy where people have to move around. And you're right, inflation does help borrowers. But the biggest borrower is the U.S. federal government, which has $17 trillion of debt. And so in comparison to, you know, your home mortgage, that's just, you know, you're comparing dollars to donuts there. It's the federal government that is the biggest winner from this inflationary process. And workers and savers are the most disadvantaged in the economy because of inflation. Inflation eats away the purchasing power of your wages. Inflation eats away at your return on savings. And so workers and savers, which is the real productive economy, that's what's getting hurt the most. And so if you go on to a gold standard, historically what you've seen is a small deflation of prices in the economy, so that every year the price of things goes down. So it's not just computers and flat screen TVs, but bacon, coffee, hamburger, all the things that we consume see lower prices year after year. So your wages actually buys more, and your savings, if you're holding gold, or if you've got money in a bank account and you're earning 3% interest and you've got deflation, then you might be earning 5% purchasing power on your money. So
all right, hold it right there, Mark. We'll be right back. Mark Thornton, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, we started right away with an interview here on the show today. It's Mark Thornton, senior fellow at the Mises Institute, editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, the author of The Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War, The Quotable Mises, The Bastiat Collection, An Essay on Economic Theory, and The Bastiat Reader, and it goes on and on like that. You can check him out at Mises.org, senior fellow there. And so we're talking about how the free market capitalism is the solution to what ails the economy, despite what you may have heard. And, of course, it's always the mythical laissez-faire 1920s in America. No matter how many new deals we have, the answer is always just, man, that laissez-faire is bringing us down. We need more regulation. We gotta have politicians iron out what's wrong in the society, and people just can't get over it. And I wanted to mention one thing, and obviously, but we probably don't have time to get too far into this, Mark, but the part about, you know, inflation benefiting homeowners, that's true in a sense, but then again, we also have these gigantic bubbles, which, as you teach, the Austrian School of Economics teaches, the bubbles and the distortions and the so-called business cycle are really the government inflationary money cycle. And that without a gold standard, that this always happens, and you end up having people who, yeah, in theory, all things being equal, they'd have bought a house in depreciating dollars. But in fact, what they did was bought it in 2006, and now they're upside down and foreclosed, and their credit's ruined, and they can never own a house again. And, you know, who knows what kind of mess. And that happened to millions of people because of the distortions in the economy, because of the lack of sound money right there. So I don't know who said it first and best. I guess Mises or something, about how all they ever do is just cause a problem and then intervene to cause more and more problems in the name of fixing the ones that are their fault in the first place. And if they would just call it all off, just like with the empire in the Middle East, just call the whole thing off and everything would be fine. That's basically the economics you're preaching here. Is that right?
Absolutely, Scott. You're absolutely right. It's not just inflation. It's not just appreciation and depreciation of your currency. But the Fed also causes economic bubbles to take place. And so, you know, since going off the gold standard and monetary deregulation, the Fed has caused the technology bubble, the housing bubble, and it's causing a current bubble, of course, in the stock market, in the bond market. And we're on high alert for trouble ahead as far as that's concerned. So, yes, the Fed does cause the business cycle. It does blow up bubbles, and it's currently blown up a bubble in the stock market and in the bond market. And you can see some of these stocks, like in social media stocks and biotechnology stocks, that the valuations are outrageously high, and the fundamentals are not nearly supportive of it. It's the Federal Reserve that's supporting this bubble in the stock market. And those things did happen under the gold standard, but not nearly as much in the 19th century when we were on the gold standard and the national monetary legislation. We did have banking panics, but they tended to be very short-lived, and they were related to the federal government's regulation of banks. But the money was sound, the purchasing power was sound, and the business cycles were much, much less severe.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I actually read recently, and I don't know, Forbes or The Economist or some mainstream type of Newsweek sort of a publication or something about how, oh, come on, this support for gold standard is crazy. You know, it hurts the poor the most. Poor people don't save. And I thought, well, come on, obviously they're begging the question there in the proper use of that term, assuming their own conclusion about why the poor don't save. Maybe they don't because the only place they could would be, I don't know, a local savings account, where, as you said, they're going to lose ground to inflation every year. It's basically a crime for them to try to save. Why would they bother? And then when you have generations of artificially low interest rates in a row, then you just have entire segments of the population who don't even know what it means to save because, again, government policy has basically forbid such a thing. But on the other hand, they also did point out, Mark, now, I guess I assume you agree with that mostly, but they also did point out, though, but high interest rates hurt for a poor person to try to borrow some money. How is somebody supposed, or poor middle class, working class people trying to come up, trying to be entrepreneurs? Isn't it much tougher for them to afford loans to expand their businesses when interest rates are high? And doesn't that kind of hold the economy back?
Well, Scott, under the gold standard, Americans on average saved about 10 to 12% of their income each year. They could put it in the bank and realizing it would not depreciate in value, but they would earn interest on their money, and then we would build a substantial nest egg. And so most Americans saved, and they tended to save in double digits of their income. But under the current system of fiat money, which is rapidly depreciating in value and not appreciating in value, you have no incentive to save. And so as a consequence, if you did save, you're going to earn very little interest because of what the Fed is doing. And then they're going to tax the interest that you do earn. So it's a losing proposition. And so Americans quite naturally have gone from being frugal, saving for the future, providing money to banks to make mortgage loans, which typically were like 4%, you know, all the time in the 1950s and 1960s. So mortgages were readily affordable. In the current situation, Americans don't save. And our savings rate has actually been negative in some of the past few years. And now it's still less than 5%. And I think the only reason Americans have got positive savings now is that they're so concerned about instability in the economy, and they're so concerned about the future of their jobs. And so, you know, I think it's just emergency type savings that people are doing today. And in the absence of that perceived instability, which I think is justified, Americans wouldn't be saving anything at all. But it's all policy driven.
Yeah, they're basically, you're saying they're willing to stuff paper money in their mattress at a loss just to be safe because, hey, it's better than not having it all, leaving it in the bank, and, oh, it's gone.
Yeah, people are putting money in the mattress all the time. You know, the government's got a war on cash, but people are saving money outside of the banking system. And that's true in the United States. It's true in many the European countries. It's obviously very true in Greece and Italy, Spain and Portugal. Places like that, that they're afraid of the banking system. And, you know, the central governments of the world have put in bail-in provisions into their banking system so that if large banks go under, it's not the taxpayer that's going to have to pay for it. It's the depositors who are going to lose a certain percentage of their deposits. And so, you know, that's the type of war on cash and war on people that governments are doing systematically throughout the world.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's the music. Thanks very much for your time, Mark. Great to talk to you again. We need to do this some more. We only got to half of what I wanted to ask you about, in fact, after all
that.
Yeah,
well, come see us. Come see us at Mises.org.
There you go. Mises.org, the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Appreciate it. We'll be right back, yo.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. All right. Man, I had so much more I want to talk about with Mark Thornton. I like that guy, man. Mises.org for the Mises Institute. They're more free market than you, man. I think that's their official slogan. We're as free market as somebody could possibly be. Yeah, go check them out, Mises.org. Now, you know, this Nazi roof and his mass murder in South Carolina has really taken the focus off of the cops and put it on white supremacy in general, which, you know, again, for you black folks, I can understand why, yeah, it's all one big thing to you. I don't know, I guess the... there's a point, it's that lone wolf, Nazi, gun-toting, civilian slaughtering murderers like this roof guy are pretty much impossible to isolate, identify, predict, stop. It's just a horrible damn thing. And he's not going to get away with it. They say he tried to blow his brains out but ran out of bullets. He had already done too much killing for his suicide to go off. But, so he'll be held accountable. Then you got guys who are cops, tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them across the country, who aren't officially Nazis at all, who don't necessarily even in private talk the way this guy Roof talked. And yet they kill unarmed black guys all day and get away with it. Two or three people a day die at the hands of the police. And no, actually it is, you know, by a bare majority, I believe, whites who get killed by the cops. Although they're obviously a much larger percentage of the population of the country. I think, what, 65% or 70% or something like that. And blacks are about 13%. So, I think it's 65%, something like that. And they're killed at almost equal numbers. So much higher rates. And of course, as I keep trying to point out, it's not because necessarily they're white supremacists. It's just, as the activists point out a lot, it's structural racism. Like, hey, you know what? The government makes their revenue off of preying on mass numbers of the poorest, least politically connected people who, as the saying goes, happen to be black. They don't have political power. They're poor. They're easy to shake down. They're easy to kill and get away with killing from the cops' point of view. And not necessarily from anyone's point of view, but certainly for cops, they can virtually always get away with it. Washington Post did a thing. Out of 5,000 of these, there are 54 prosecutions and then 24 convictions, something like that. Out of 5,000 people killed by the cops. And they do, literally, they come in at a rate of 2 to 3 per day. And so that is the civil rights crisis, right? This idiot, you know, and I know George Zimmerman wasn't a cop and whatever, and it's a blurry line, but it seems like if there's a real crisis that something can be done about, or where... you know, at least this guy, Roof, was not sworn to protect the people of that church. You know what I mean? He's some Nazi piece of crap. But, you know, when the so-called security force, when the official protectors who claim for themselves a monopoly on the right to force you to pay for them to maintain a monopoly on the right to be your security force, when they turn against you, when they're just as violent and dangerous to you and the people in your neighborhood as the Ku Klux Klan, then, which, you know, as this guy Roof pointed out, hardly exists anymore except on the internet. Thank God for that. It seems like that's the thing where there's a real crisis and where, you know, and where the, for my taste, where all the hashtags should be. Accountability. Accountability. Is there any doubt? I mean, does anybody think for a minute that Roof is going to get an all-white jury that's going to pat him on the head and send him home? Hell no. He's going to be sentenced almost certainly to death, but certainly he will be in custody for the rest of his life. He's going to life in prison without the possibility of parole. There's just no doubt about that. That's the minimum sentence that he's going to get. So as horrible as what he did is, and the political terroristic import of it and trying to provoke a reaction, all that, as important as all that is, what are we doing about it? We need to indict cops. That's what we need to do. We need to focus on indicting cops. And check this out. This is a real thing. Somebody just sent me this morning. In New York, a special prosecutor for police killings for now. And this is an Associated Press piece. It's running at thestate.com, which is, I forgot who that is, the South Carolina, the State, that is the name of their newspaper, I forgot. Anyway, amid national debate over holding officers criminally accountable for killings by police, New York State is giving such cases special consideration by appointing the Attorney General to investigate them for now. The move comes after police officers weren't criminally charged last year in deadly encounters with unarmed men in New York and elsewhere. Critics pressed to take such cases away from local district attorneys, arguing they didn't have enough professional distance to investigate and prosecute police who helped them build cases. Hallelujah. Absolutely right. With lawmakers unable to agree on an approach as the legislative session ended, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced Tuesday he'd use executive power to appoint Attorney General Eric Schneiderman for a year as a special prosecutor for police killings. I don't believe this is the perfect alternative, but I believe it is the best alternative at this time, the governor said, adding that he'd keep working toward legislation next year. And so I... presumably that would mean the Attorney General's office will appoint special prosecutors, obviously under him, to actually do the investigating and so forth. And that's no guarantee of justice. Not for a minute. It's no panacea or cure for this at all. But it's, my God, that's the most official recognition I've ever heard of. The governor of New York is saying, hey, no offense to our wonderful and heroic assistant district attorneys and district attorneys out there, but it's just a profession. We need professional distance, right? Like, all right, go ahead. Use whatever euphemism you need. They have a severe conflict of interest in prosecuting their, basically, employees. You try to pretend there's a difference between the police and the prosecutors. It's really not like that. And it's just asking one to prosecute another as though they're no different at all, really. And, but yeah, so to have the Attorney General do it, that doesn't solve the problem. That doesn't guarantee that now you're going to get justice, but it might mean that the new special prosecutor doesn't feel the same kind of pressures that a local prosecutor does to go ahead and let this slide. It's the best recognition of this progress, the highest level recognition of this problem, I'm trying to say, that I've seen so far. And a huge precedent set, and this should be the rallying cry. This should be everywhere. Hey, like in New York, they said we gotta bring in outside prosecutors. You know, I've been saying things like, get a prosecutor from another state. I mean, god dang, man. In the States, get a prosecutor from another county, another district, however it's set up. Not all states have counties, it turns out. But however their state prosecutorial jurisdictions are set up, they should just have somebody from the other side of the state come in to investigate police killings, that kind of thing. I think this is great. It's a great start, and it's a great measure of recognition, official recognition of the problem, of the conflict of interest between the prosecutors and the cops in these cases. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right. Yeah, I'm for taking down the Confederate flag. I'm for taking down all the flags. I mean, the Confederacy, that government oversaw a hell of a lot of evil in a short amount of time, but think how much more evil has been done under the cover of the U.S. flag, including the entire area of Southern slavery, other than those couple of short years at war there. 4 years. Well, pretty long 4 years, I guess. Anyway, yeah, the statism. Gotta get over it. The statism, you know, it's kind of a pseudo-racism, right? Come on, we're all Americans. I mean, except the Arabs. Let's go get them Arabs! And so, like, for a minute, remember back in 2002, 2003? Why? Even blacks and red Indians were honorary white people for a little while as we stand united against Iraq that didn't have anything to do with any attacks against the United States and would never dream of doing such a thing. It's that same kind of, you know, exclusivism that makes others subhuman and okay for the killing. You know what I mean? Hey, check out my new commercial I made. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Also this. Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation to the jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support the Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verde Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Puriscal, Costa Rica, and he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day...
Hey.
As well as a 7-what?
They stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day is covered. You can learn and practice some skills or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. ScottHorton.org/raffle.
That's funny. You know, I never, ever, ever have a problem with the VLC player except when I'm live doing a show. Oh, you know what? We'll just stop playing this file for a minute. And then continue playing the file. Oh, all right. Oh, man, this is not good. An officer-involved incident. I hate it when they do that. Don't you hate that passive voice? And in fact, this reporter I really like, a local Austin reporter, Quita Culpepper. Hutto police, other law enforcement responding to officer involved incident. That means a cop killed somebody. A cop shot somebody to death. Officer involved. So you might mean that somebody did something to the cop? Or no, that's every time. Somebody did something to the cop, they say, somebody murdered a cop! A hero cop was ambushed and slaughtered! He had a child! But a cop murders somebody. Well, the officer was involved in the death of the guy. Somehow, you know, bullets flew out of his gun when it discharged. Oh, God. Anyway. Hey, those are the breaks when the cops kill you. You know, it's like when the Israelis kill you. Hey, we were just retaliating for, I don't know. They were trying to resist our enslavement. That's not okay. You don't have permission to do that. Always you started it. Always they're the defenders. What's the benefit of having Twitter in my right eye all day? Oh, look, a cop just killed somebody. I wonder who's going to investigate. Yeah, the cop's best friend. The other cop. And then who's he going to report to? Their other best friend, the district attorney, all of whom agree that there's no such thing as law that governs their behavior. That's for the rubes, man. That's for kids in government school to believe. All right. The raffle thing. Hey, man, if you guys are interested in this, it's going pretty well, by the way, so far. I hate to tell you that your chances of winning are steadily diminishing, but it's going to be really cool, man. Vacation to Costa Rica, if you want to go, if you're interested in that, hey, tell your friends about it. Hey, you guys, I know this radio show host, he's raffling off a vacation to Costa Rica. Might be worth the chance for the $50, you know? Check it out at scotthorton.org/raffle to get all your details there. But, guaranteed good time there. And you can go whenever you want. The drawing is on the 15th of July. But you can go whenever you want. You can go for Christmas, man. You can do whatever you want. Once you got your ticket. Oh, and by the way, anybody who enters this thing, all the people who have bought a raffle ticket, again, scotthorton.org/raffle, all y'all have half off to go down there from now on, no matter what. Just for entering. So that's cool, too. All right. I'll try not to beat you over the head about the fundraiser anymore. There's a fundraiser going on. Go to scotthorton.org/donate, scotthorton.org/raffle to learn all about it. Oh, and there's Fascism versus Capitalism is the audiobook narrated by me, Lou Rockwell's book, Fascism versus Capitalism. And you can find the link to that in the right-hand margin at my website, scotthorton.org. And it's also on amazon.com and audible.com and itunes.com, Fascism versus Capitalism. So, you know, get it. You can sign up for Audible and get it free. And in fact, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you get it free and I get a kickback from there. audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. There's a link at scotthorton.org about that too. All right. Now, I know I'm kind of all over the place in this segment, but I got lots of different things to talk about and very little time. First of all, I wanted to point out this story. You probably heard of this one. The Kansas woman facing 30 years in prison for medical marijuana use. She was not even getting high at all. She wasn't hiding behind the excuse in any way. Even if she was sick, she wasn't even smoking weed and getting high. She was simply using cannabis oil to treat her Crohn's disease, and it was helping. And then her bright and cheerful and innocent son accidentally mistook the people at his school for his caregivers, for his friends and compatriots, when in fact they are his enemies, of course. And when he debunked their ridiculous drug war propaganda about pot, don't say it has no medicinal purpose. My mom uses it for medicinal purposes, the boy said in class. Blam, they came and kidnapped the boy, took him away from his mother. She's now facing 30 years in the penitentiary. 30 years in the penitentiary. Oh, yeah, and you'll take off your hat and cry at the ball game when they play Land of the Free and Home of the Brave and all that. But I don't see you breaking her out. 30 years in prison. Because, oh, man, I don't want to send the wrong message to the children that using marijuana is okay. But, yeah, the right message is that other people's kids should be kidnapped and taken away from them and put in foster care, and the mothers should be locked in the penitentiary for 30 years for using cannabis oil to treat their illnesses. That's the right message to send to children. You're not free. You're the property of some hysterical middle-aged white woman's fears. Go and lay down and die. In this case, a middle-aged white woman is the victim, too. But anyway, we all know that is who is the perpetrator of this whole thing. Republicans' wives. Oh, well, send the wrong message to the children. Well, them in the police lobby. And that's it. The prison lobby. But what civilians among us? Terrified housewives. No, we can't legalize pot. Think of how horrible it would be. Yeah, this lady would be free. And have her son back. What a nightmare. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Reza Marashi on the line. He is at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. They're with Trita Parsi and forget the other guy. He's real good, though. Anyway, so he's written a couple of good pieces here. Ending the Iranian-Saudi Cold War. That's at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. Ending the Iranian-Saudi Cold War. And then this one, brand new, at the National Interest. Iran nuclear talks, clearing the final hurdle, and that's where I want to start. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Reza?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Happy to have you here. Hey, so the final hurdle, sanctions relief and inspections and verification, you say, both of which are resolvable?
I think so. And the reality of the situation is that both sides are essentially looking at a Chinese menu of options here that can solve the technical problems that are preventing solutions on both issues, sanctions relief and inspections verification. So now it's up to political leaders to find solutions that are feasible for their needs, both in Washington and in Tehran. That's not easy to do. If it was easy to do, it would already be done by now. But the clock is ticking. Both sides would prefer to get this done sooner rather than later. But there's going to be a lot of haggling between now and June 30th, or perhaps a few days even after June 30th, when they try to seal this thing and get it done.
Well, and by the way, if they need another couple of few days, is that going to be that big of a deal?
I don't think so. I think what we're really looking at here is July 9th, because Congress comes back into session on July 10th. And if nothing is presented to Congress when they come back into session, Congress has the ability to extend its review period of any deal that's signed from 30 days to 60 days. And if you have a longer review period, that could add additional layers of complication to a negotiation process that's already very complicated. So I don't think the Obama administration wants that. I don't think the Iranians want that. So it's going to affect the calculus. But that being said, that does not prevent the possibility that this could go beyond July 9th or 10th. I don't think either side is going to agree to a deal that they don't feel meets their needs. And finding solutions to these problems technically is possible. I think politically is also possible, but the politics on both sides is where the real complications come in. So leaders have to be willing to take risks for peace in order to make this thing work.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so in your article, you say when it comes to sanctions relief, there's some things that can be done immediately and hopefully enough to make up for the fact that not everything can be done immediately. And you're differentiating between the U.S., EU, and UN levels of sanctions. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that there's a variety of things that that can be done without the White House having to go to Congress and ask them to lift sanctions. This Congress has not played ball with the White House really on anything, foreign policy or domestic policy. So the Obama administration is going to have to look into its toolkit to see what it can do on its own. And, you know, I think it has a couple of options that would be relatively appealing to the Iranians, at least for the first phase of a deal, because this is the deal that's going to be multi-phased. And that ranges from unfreezing Iranian assets and returning them directly to the Iranian government. We've had various assets frozen from anywhere between 30 some odd years to, 3 to 4 years. And removing different designations of Iranian individuals and entities that had previously fallen under sanctions designations, to waiving sanctions that are already on the books. You know, if you add all of these things together and you front load a deal, that could provide substantial relief in the beginning. It's not going to be the end all be all. It's going to require a lot more hard work on the part of the United States, but it would be an important first step to demonstrate our commitment to diplomacy.
Yeah. In other words, the Iranian side, they need to be able to go back to the rest of the politicians in Tehran and to the Iranian people and identify some wins that they achieved before they're going to do their part at all. And in fact, as you say in the article, they've already gone, way beyond their fair share under the interim deal, but now it's time for the payoff or they're going to be in trouble. After all, it's just their John Kerry over there trying to cut this deal, right? He's not Iran. He's just their foreign minister.
It's very much a situation where both sides don't feel like they're getting what they need, then the process is not going to be sustainable and a deal won't be sustainable. And it's very much a process where the Iranians believe that they gave more than they received when the interim nuclear deal was signed. Now, right or wrong, perception is reality when it comes to these negotiations. So,
yeah. Well, they have a pretty strong case to make on that point, it would seem like to me.
And I think that's going to be probably the trickiest issue to try and resolve, sanctions relief, because Iran has already agreed to make a variety of limitations on the various technical aspects of its nuclear program. Not all of the kinds of concessions that the United States would like to see, but far more than any U.S. official could have possibly imagined 18 months ago. And it requires a certain level of intellectual honesty on the part of U.S. officials to acknowledge that. So I give the U.S. officials who do acknowledge that a lot of credit.
Yeah. Well, and the ones who refuse to acknowledge it, I think, look pretty foolish, because when they announced that agreed framework, the last big hurdle, it was pretty impressive and, beyond what I thought that they would get. And, that's for sure, at least at that point anyway. Now that brings us to the other part of what you're talking about here in the piece, and that is how far the Iranians will allow the inspections and verification to go. I mean, ultimately, they're literally to re-sign the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, but they're going to have other subsidiary arrangements and agreements to what degree, I don't know, I guess. But there are obviously some places for some real confrontations here, because at least in the past, the Americans have demanded access to things that are only tangentially related or, kind of secondary to anything that's really under the IAEA's purview for investigation. Actual nuclear materials in machines, being introduced into machines. But we want to look at your military bases and your missiles and your centrifuge factories and all these other things. And do you really think there's enough split in the difference and middle ground and compromise room there between past American demands or whatever they're demanding now and what the Iranians can be, reasonably expected to accept?
I think so, because neither side wants this process to fail, first and foremost. And beyond that, I think that there is an increasing acknowledgement on the part of Western countries that Iran's nuclear program is already the most heavily inspected program in the world. The additional measures that will be brought in if and when a final deal is signed is going to add to what is already the most heavily inspected program in the world. And those things will be locked into place, not just for 10 years, 15 years, but some of them for the life of Iran's nuclear program. So to sacrifice what would clearly be a net gain in an unprecedented fashion in the history of inspection verification regime over a few issues that relate to sovereignty, sensitivities, or whatever other classification the Iranians might describe it as, I think would be a mistake. So finding a way to split the difference here where we can say with as much certainty as possible that every link in the supply chain of Iran's nuclear program is monitored from start to finish, while also allowing the Iranians to maintain sovereignty and be eventually treated like any other country with a nuclear program in the world, is going to have to be the end game here. And there's a couple of different roads that can get the two sides there. It's just a matter of them, again, finding one that's politically digestible in both of their respective capitals.
Mm-hmm. Well, from my point of view, it seems like Obama is much more invested in this. He and Kerry both are much more invested in this now than they were in the past. They were more willing to declare a failure, I guess, as Gareth Porter put it, as long as they could make it Iran's fault as best they could. They were perfectly happy to throw their hands up and go back to the horrible status quo as best they could. But it seems like now they really do have the political will, at least in the White House, to push this thing through. I guess we'll still, like you mentioned, got to see what Congress does with it. But anyway, reasons for real optimism. And when we get back with Reza Marashi on the other side of this breakyard, we're going to talk about the upcoming new and improved, possibly, relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Hang tight.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Hey, all you people who listen to these interview archives on the podcast feed there, you do know they come from this live show I do, noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network, right? Yeah, it's true. You can hear the whole show archives at scotthorton.org, too, if you like. All right. Right now, I'm talking with, well, people tell me, you know what, I listened to your interviews for years before I figured out they came from something else. Well, god dang, I guess I should say that more often or something. All right, I got Reza Marashi on the line. He's at the National Iranian American Council. They push for peace between this country and that one. I like that. He's written a couple of very interesting pieces for your brain here. Iran nuclear talks clearing the final hurdles is one, and then we're about to get to this one on Iran and Saudi in a second. But I wanted to ask you here about this dispute resolution joint commission that you propose here that maybe if we can't quite get the PMD issues and the inspections worked out by the deadline, maybe we can create a little commission, kick the can down the road a little bit, but then they'll have the flexibility to go ahead and resolve the issue, but it'll already have the big red stamp of approval on it. By then, the final deal will. It'll just include this commission, and we'll relegate these issues to this kind of lower status, which I'm all for, kind of, except it seems like it might be a tripwire there, where if the Iranians push back at all, then all the Republicans can say after the final deal is signed, oh, no, look, they're cheating. Oh, no, they refuse to go along with their agreements and blah, blah, blah. And that could set us up for a problem. But maybe I'm missing something. What do you think?
Well, I think you're going to have Republicans and probably even some Democrats sniping at any final agreement that might be signed, no matter what happens. But I don't think most members of Congress, really any members of Congress, are going to be in a position to gauge what is or is not a violation by the Americans, the Iranians, or anyone else that's party to this deal unless they're briefed by the negotiators who have the access directly to the classified information that Congress otherwise is not able to have. So at the end of the day, if some kind of joint commission is put together, it's going to be the responsibility of Iran and the P5 plus one countries to figure out how they, you know, parse through the issues that would come to the joint commission. So if some countries in the joint commission decide that, okay, for example, Iran has committed a violation, then how do they decide as a commission together if, in fact, it is a violation? How do they decide what kind of penalties will be brought forward? Is it going to be one penalty by any side and the whole thing goes to hell in a handbasket? There's no more deal? Or is there going to be a menu of options that, you know, lead up to perhaps abandoning a deal, but that's not the first step that you go to, right? So maybe there's some kind of sanction. Maybe there's some kind of penalty. These are the kinds of things that they have to parse through here that have to get the approval from all of their respective political leaders, which, of course, makes it complicated. But the idea here is that they decide together what constitutes a violation the same way that they decide together what constitutes success. That way, you either win together or you lose together.
Yeah.
And that actually increases the likelihood of success.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, so let me ask you this now. What happens if the talks fail? And I'll go ahead and take, oh, no, they're going to make bombs and there's going to be a nuclear war and attack on Israel off the table, because we all know that that's a fantasy. All they ever had was a safeguarded civilian nuclear program. But the politics of failure on either sides could go all kinds of ways. But are you worried about what might happen?
Yeah, I'm very worried about what would happen, because we were at the precipice of war just a couple of years ago, and we got lucky, frankly. And I don't even believe in luck. Luck is for losers. But we got lucky that both the United States and Iran decided to step back from the brink and try this whole diplomacy thing that had never truly been tried in any kind of serious and sustained fashion. Now, it took us quite a long time to get to the brink of war. If the negotiations fail and there's no deal, it's not going to take the same amount of time, years, to get back to the brink of war. It's going to get back to the brink, I think, much, much quicker. Mm-hmm. And not only will we get back to the brink of war much quicker, but the forces of sanity and pragmatism, moderation, call it what you will, yeah, in Washington and in Tehran and in other capitals that helped get us to the precipice of not war, but a diplomatic solution, if the deal fails, they'll be emasculated. So there's not going to be that line of defense, that line of sanity, that line of, yeah, pragmatism standing in the way.
The
it's going to empower
sides,
the,
yeah,
worst elements on both sides. Yeah. And I think that gets us to war, or at least the potential for war, much, much quicker and in a much more serious and real way.
All right. But here's the thing, though. Specifically speaking, for, well, you know, I know the Americans can just make up things and launch wars if they want to. I'm not discounting that. But, and I know it wouldn't be exactly status quo, it would be a whole new world we live in if the talks fail. But on the other hand, do you think it's automatic that they would say, well, that's it, we've had it with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement, and we're going to go North Korea and start making nukes now? Because I don't think they would. And it would take that to be even what amounts to not a good enough casus belli for me, but it seems like the kind of thing that would really drive the Americans to actually go ahead and bomb Natanz or whatever it is.
I don't think that if a deal fails that Iran will immediately dash to build a nuclear weapon. I think that there are a handful of steps that happen between diplomacy failing and a potential Iranian nuclear weapon being constructed.
But you just think the Americans will attack them anyway?
No, I don't think that that will be the first step. It doesn't matter if you have a Republican president or a Democrat president. I don't think they're going to want to immediately go to war. But what we've seen over the history of this whole nuclear impasse is that the United States will escalate the conflict through sanctions, cyber warfare, secret assassination, some punitive measure. And rather than backing down, the Iranians escalate in response. So you have this cycle of escalation that moves both sides closer and closer to war, right, because neither side backs down.
And as you said, the sides that always preach that they only understand force would be the winners politically on both sides of the fight, in both countries, too, going into the crisis, into the new crisis.
Exactly. So I think both sides understand this. that's the kind of outcome or scenario that they're trying to avoid. But the only way to avoid it is to continue producing success at the negotiating table.
Yeah. Man, well, I'm sure with it, it's always been unfortunate, I think, as Stephen Walt put it, that everybody who's actually not that concerned about Iran's nuclear program itself are all the ones who are most concerned that we get a deal, because they're, you know, whether it's a fake casus belli or not, we know that it is one or could be one, could lead to a real calamity. And all the people who say that they're just obsessively worried about Iran getting a nuclear weapon are the ones who are always working to scotch the deal and prevent there for being these new, highly expanded regime of inspections, making sure that just such an outcome that they stay nuclear weaponless stays the reality of the situation. So, but again, at least, you know, does seem to be a lot of momentum at the very top levels, at least, to get this deal done by the end of the month. And I'm still optimistic on that. I'm not optimistic on the clock, though, Reza. The drums are hitting, and so we got to go. Unless you could stay one more segment to talk about Saudi, or do you need to run?
Yeah, I can stay and talk a few more minutes about Saudi. It's no problem.
Okay, cool, because it's this great article you wrote here, and I want to hear what you say all about it. It's Reza Marashi, formerly at the State Department, now at the National Iranian American Council, writing in the National Interest and the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Okay, we got Reza Marashi on the line. He is at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIACouncil.org. NIACouncil.org. We were just talking about this piece, Iran Nuclear Talks, Clearing the Final Hurdles. That's at the National Interest. And this one is at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, Ending the Iranian-Saudi Cold War. And actually seems like more of a proxy war being fought really ever since George W. Bush invaded Iraq for Iran back in 2003, as it's depicted in the State Department cables leaked by the hero Chelsea Manning. The Saudi king, or ambassador, I guess, said to the State Department flunky that, oh, no offense, I don't understand it. It was always you, me, and Saddam against Iran ever since the revolution. But now you've handed Iraq to Iran on a golden platter, not even a silver one. And I still don't know if he got the idiom wrong or if he deliberately was emphasizing it was even nicer than a silver platter, a golden one. But anyway, sure was right about that. And the Saudis have been back in the Sunni-based insurgency ever since in a massive civil war, which is now region-wide. And you're saying, hey, instead of this getting worse and worse, and maybe even eventually ending in a real hot war between Iran and Saudi, which would obviously necessarily involve the Americans as well, maybe they could get along. Really? Come on.
I think so. And, you know, there's demonstrated history of the ability to get along. I mean, oftentimes when you look at the relationship between regional powers in any area of the world, whether it's the Middle East or Asia or Africa or anywhere else, you see the relationship between regional powers kind of oscillate between competition and confrontation. And we've seen Iran-Saudi relations go through both phases. And right now they're in the confrontation phase. Since Iranian President Rouhani came into office in 2013, his administration, with the support of the supreme leader and Iran's national security establishment, have tried to shift the relationship from confrontation to cooperation, you know, from enemies to rivals, if you will. And the Saudis have been either non-responsive or resistant to the idea for a variety of reasons. This is unfortunate because any durable solution to the conflicts that are burning the region alive right now is going to require buy-in from both the Iranians and the Saudis. If both sides aren't buying in, the problems will get worse before they get better.
Yeah. All right. Well, now, so you talk about going to the Gulf and talking with some Saudis about the situation, and They sound pretty intractable.
That's how they sound. And the unfortunate reality is that, at least right now, the rhetoric that they say publicly and privately largely matches. And I think that you have a new cast of characters in power in Saudi Arabia right now, new king all the way on down, who perhaps have a little bit less experience managing the affairs of not just the state, but also Saudi Arabia's foreign policy and national security interests. And they're going to have to learn the hard way that durable solutions require the buy-in of each country with the capacity to wreck the solution. You cannot impose your will on the other side. It only incentivizes them to respond and adversely affect your interests. So you're either winning together or you're losing together. This is a common theme in international affairs. It doesn't matter which two countries you're talking about.
Yeah, they always treat this like a zero-sum game. If Iran is doing better, then it's at Saudi's expense. And I guess, I mean, there must be some truth to that, right? If the Saudis want to set the oil price here or there, if the Iranians are out from under sanctions, they can have a stronger hand in determining whether they want to go along with that or not. Something like that. I don't know. Whatever. I'm sure you got better examples of the kinds of state power politics where maybe it is kind of zero-sum. They do have things to lose. But in terms of the population of Saudi Arabia or Arabia in general and Iran, the more, you know, interaction of wealth and trade for everyone, the better, right? There's no reason that they should necessarily have to have confrontation at all.
Exactly. There's nothing inherent that would require the two sides to be in a permanent state of confrontation. And as recently as 10 to 11 years ago, both the Iranian government and the Saudi government, and I mentioned this in the article that I wrote for the Cairo Review, both the Iranian government and the Saudi government made the strategic decision to abandon confrontation and instead try and promote cooperation. And they very publicly announced policy initiatives to go in that direction. So the precedent is there. It just requires the foresight, the vision, and the courage for political leaders in Tehran and Saudi Arabia to readopt those policies. The Iranian leadership has adopted those policies. The Saudis have yet to adopt them. So we're going to need to see some kind of reciprocation, at the very least for dialogue. They've been cutting a deal. Saudi Arabia just needs to be willing to talk, and right now they're not. Yeah. Because once they start talking to the Iranians in some kind of serious and sustained fashion, this Iranophobia straw man that they've built up is going to come crumbling down. And they don't want it to crumble down yet. And that's unfortunate, because it exacerbates the conflict the longer they perpetuate this.
Yeah. Well, now, on the other hand, are you sure it's true that the Iranians have been so willing to get along? I know the Saudis' view, as you quote in here, too, is, you know, they sound like Krauthammer. No, the Iranians are building an empire. They're on the march. They're going to dominate the region. They're in Sana'a. They're in Baghdad. Never mind how they got to Baghdad. And of course, the terrible war going on in Syria. And they're building a gigantic empire. And you just want to characterize that as trying to get along in the Saudis as the intractable ones, but is that fair?
I think it's fair, because there's a handful of examples over the past 18 months that demonstrate the Iranian intent and the Iranian desire to hit the refresh button, hit the restart button on their bilateral relationship with Saudi Arabia. They've extended the olive branch numerous times, not just rhetorically, but also through concrete action. The Saudis have not responded in kind. And it takes two to tango. It's that simple.
Can you give
it's
us some examples
science.
Of those? The recent
absolutely. Absolutely. President Rouhani's first press conference that he gave immediately after being elected and immediately after taking office, he prioritized improving the relationship with Saudi Arabia as Iran's top foreign policy priority. So that's the rhetorical initiative. They followed through by sending the deputy foreign minister to Saudi Arabia. They followed through by sending the Iranian foreign minister to King Abdullah's funeral in Saudi Arabia. They followed through by the Iranian foreign minister reaching out to his Saudi counterpart, unplanned and unsolicited, at the UN General Assembly. So you have three examples of outreach right there where the Iranians have tried. And you also have, according to European officials that I've spoken to, two Iranian efforts to reinvigorate relations through what's called track two diplomacy, and the Saudis have been non-responsive. So really, that's five examples of how the Iranians have tried to reach out.
Well, I think I have a sixth, too, would be Rouhani and the speech that he gave right after they announced the agreed framework. He said he wanted to, you know, start anew with relations with all the neighbors, which obviously was meant Saudi first and foremost.
Sure. Yeah, you could say that, too. So at the end of the day, if the Saudis are going to say we need to see something tangible for the Iranians, from the Iranians, so where they demonstrate their intent, they need to articulate what that something is. To say that it should be the Iranians, you know, abandoning Assad in Syria, well, that's not realistic. That's what happens after you negotiate, not before you negotiate. So,
well,
and the Saudis,
as far as them being behind the Houthis in Yemen, that's all a big red herring anyway. You know, that's one of those drop the gun when they're not even holding one.
Yeah, I think Iran's role in Yemen has been overblown, and the Saudis have, I think, intentionally over. And look, you don't have to take my word for it. The United States government has came out and said very openly that the Iranians aren't controlling the Houthis. So there you have it.
Right. But, yeah, we're still helping the Saudis bomb them anyway, not that – they even need that cover story. They apparently don't even need a cover story. We'll just go ahead.
Well, what the real hope is that cooler heads prevail so that innocent people don't have to continue to suffer. The Saudis have a better way. They have a way out. And the United States actually deserves some credit because privately we've been trying to encourage the Saudis to take that way out.
Well, while our guys are helping them pick their targets, according to the Wall Street Journal. But anyway, hey, thanks for your time. Great to talk to you again, Reza. Appreciate it. Reza Marashi,
much appreciated.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up for the day. And, you know, I don't know, man. I'm sorry. I guess I'm a radio show host, so I should have some kind of wise thing to say about all the racial issues and this and that. But I guess I just look at it like the very worst aspect of racism in our society is the empire, of course, occupying and bombing and destroying and taking crappy little countries and slamming them up against the wall just to prove we mean business. The Michael Ledeen Doctrine. It's a unipolar world now, you see. The U.S. government, still, as Martin Luther King called it, is the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the planet Earth. And mostly toward black and brown people. Whether sub-Saharan Africans, or Arabs, or, for that matter, Berbers and Tuaregs and Vietnamese and Koreans. Yeah, they're savage killers, man. So that's my thing. What's the very worst thing that's going on? The empire. Okay, so that'll be the thing that I oppose then. And that's the thing that's the most racist in practice. Militarism. And of course, then there's the police state and the horrible inflationary money generated boom bust cycle. And all the rest of the horrible things the government does to people. But as far as how do you prevent somebody from being a racist, teach them libertarianism, man. Did you see Jack Hunter from Rare? He used to be the Southern Avenger, pro-Ron Paul guy back in 08 and 12. Went to work for Rand Paul and has now just thoroughly denounced his former self, basically, as a conservative, as a right-winger, and a bigot. And he's saying he wasn't really a bigot necessarily, but just de facto because he was on his side, the right. And at war against everybody else, and it never mattered how wrong he was, and it never mattered what anybody else thought. He's gone on TV to talk about it, and you know, the left will still attack him and go, oh, look at what a Klansman this guy is. He never was a Klansman. I don't think anybody had him on tape using the N-word necessarily. He was just an unapologetic, you know, southern right-wing conservative radio shock jock type. Very anti-immigration. And if it had been, you know, as he says in his Daily Beast piece, the McKinney pool party situation, whatever, with a cop. Tackle the 14-year-old girl. There was a time where he would have taken the cop's side just because the cop was white and a cop and part of de facto the right and on our side against them, whoever them are, and blacks are included in them. And Jack Hunter has just said, you know what happened to me, though? Learned about libertarianism. And so how can I be a conservative when now I know all this stuff? It just doesn't work anymore. And now all of a sudden... and I'm just paraphrasing from his Daily Beast piece. You look at it, Jack Hunter, the Southern Avenger, wrote this for the Daily Beast. And he's just saying, well, now he's an individualist. He's not on the right. He doesn't have to take their side against whoever, whatever, today's talking points on high from talk radio land or whatever. He's an individualist. And so, geez, that means, obviously, he's on the side of the 14-year-old girl, whatever the color of her skin is, against state power. Brutalizing her for no reason. And he's just saying, and look at my Facebook page, man. This is what right-wingers are, and I ain't that. Forget it. Libertarianism cured me of my conservatism. That's his rap. And that's why he's perfect on race now. Everybody's an individual. What race? This is ridiculous. And he said, even though he used to wear the Confederate flag wrestling mask and all this stuff as his Southern Avenger persona, he says, you know what, he never looked at it from the other point of view. And he says that his argument was not a racist argument. He was not an avowed racist at any point. He just didn't care about what anybody else thought. And so, yeah, of course, it's the heritage of our great-grandfathers who fought so bravely and so poorly, etc., etc. But then, huh, once he became a libertarian and an individualist, all of a sudden that gave him the gift of empathy. All of a sudden, he learned that, well, wait, if everybody's an individual, then, huh, I wonder what they think of something. And then, ta-da! Oh, I get it. So if you're a black guy and you're driving by and you see the Confederate flag up there, it means something entirely different to you than some brave heritage of you know, skill in combat, you know, devoid of all other context, of some white guy's great-grandfather, huh? Oh, I get it. It means... stay in your place, boy, to you. Oh, I get it now. Take it down. Take it down. What are you doing? How could you do that to your neighbors? Just because they're black, you're going to, you know, you're basically giving them the ultimate insult all day long. It doesn't matter what it means to you. It's what it means to them that counts. That don't you think overrides your pride? I like Larry Wilmore on the comedy show. I was like, how come you're not flying the Union Jack? Where's your heritage there? Nobody cares about that. Anyway. It's libertarianism that fixed Jack Hunter's brain. That's my point. He never was a racist. I'm not saying he ever was. And he's not saying he ever was. He's just saying he kind of just sort of de facto was, because whose side was he on? The white right. And not like the fringe, like nationalist racists, avowed racists, but just... you know, American conservatism. Us versus everybody else. That's the name of the game, right? Everybody else, they'll never stop until they get us. Ah! That's the definition of conservatism. Everyone's trying to get me. No. Conservatism in America. And so Jack Hunter, yeah. No, everybody's an individual, so that's it. Which, after all, that's the part of Martin Luther King that America celebrates. They exclude every other thing he ever said, which he was terrible on economics, so I would exclude a lot of what he said about that stuff too. But the one thing that everyone agrees on, at least in principle, is that each individual person ought to be judged by who they are, by their own character, rather than some supposed racial categorization. Of course. And anyway, so... that's my brilliant, bright thing to say about race, is that if everybody had my same political ideology, it's a very Declaration of Independence-y, I mean, Just the one part about the natural rights. That part. Never mind any of the rest of that stuff. There's some bad stuff in there. But anyway, but the part about the natural rights, what's supposed to be, as Martin Luther King said, the creed of this land, that, hey, everybody's born free. Everybody's an individual, right? All right. So how could you be a racist if you accept that, which is obviously the truth? So there you go. Anyway, so that's my solution to racism. Oh, that and also independent prosecutors for killer cops, man. Accountability for government armed killers. Accountability for them. I read a thing where, oh yeah, man, Baltimore's going to hell because the cops are so terrified that there's the slightest bit of accountability for crimes that they commit against the people. They're not willing to go out there and do an actual policeman's job. They will either go out there and commit crimes, or they'll just do nothing at all. They'll just boycott the people of East or West or whichever part of Baltimore that they hate the most, where people dare to express their disapproval of being occupied. And so then your punishment is no security for you. And let the criminals run wild. And the cops don't dare intervene. That's their work slowdown for you. And why? Because it's a government monopoly. There's no free market in security. There's a black market in security. Those are the gangs that are doing all the killing, see? Because it's a black market, they're trying to create a cartel to prevent free market competition like you would have in an open market. The cops just proven that they're the enemies and not the servants of the people of Baltimore and every other town. You ever read Murray Rothbard, Anatomy of the State? It begins, what the state is not your security force. Okay, let's get real. The state is when the marauders came and conquered some farmers and then stayed and said, all right, well, we're your security force now. Pay up or die, and we'll protect you from other marauders. That's where governments come from, okay? It ain't the same as, you know, Stanley Smith Security Company. They're your enemy. I wonder why it's so hard for people to understand that. Anyway. Just turn on the news, man. Outrage after outrage. Freddie Gray's broken neck. All right. Thanks, you guys. See you tomorrow.